Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Yeah, I saw a thing about that, man, about how when the continent split apart, the gigantic brontosaurus-type plant eaters were safe from the new generations of meat-eating dinosaurs that destroyed all their kin elsewhere in the world. And so in South America, the brontosaurus-type gigantic plant eaters were able to continue evolving for another however many million years or something. And these new ones that they're finding down there in Argentina are now, I don't know how many times, many times bigger than the brachiosaurs and brontosauruses. And I think they, didn't they decide there's not even such a thing as a brontosaurus anymore? They split that into two different things. Now, what the hell do I know about dinosaurs? Nothing. I'm just saying I saw a thing on TV about it, okay? That's all. But anyway, apparently down there in South America, those, what you think of when I say the word brontosaurus, those things grew to, I don't know, 10 times that size or something. Anyway, I saw a picture of the new thigh bone that they found and the guy laying down next to it, and sure looks like an impressive thigh bone to me. Break out the measuring sticks, guys. Anyway, what a weird start to a show. Dinosaur bones. Yeah, like the American Empire. Dinosaur bones. Not quite yet. All right, well, I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. It's libertarian foreign policy, mostly. My website is scotthorton.org, and then I'm also at apsradionews.com, Daily Paul Radio, Anomaly Radio, and then, scotthorton.org. I also keep all my interview archives there. More than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. They're at scotthorton.org if you like listening to interviews. And I also got my whole show archives there and my blog. And Tony DiGirolamo, whose name I can't say, is back putting cartoons up there at the Stress Blog again, which is nice. Oh, yeah, I forgot to say you can follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. Though I quit Facebook like cigarettes. Cold turkey. Done. Have it. Okay. Yeah. I am on liberty.me. If you want to be friends on there, you can look me up. It's not a very simple address, unfortunately. It's like liberty.me/users/Scott Horton Show or something like that. I think they need to get that worked out. Or maybe, I think what, I asked Jeff Tucker, and I think he said, once I make my own publishing site, then it'll be simple like that. liberty.me/Scott Horton Show, something like that. But I haven't done that yet, because I don't know. But if any of you libertarians want to be friends on liberty.me, I'm on there. Scott Horton Show. Ooh, I have 3 pending friendship requests on there right now. And now I'm clicking check marks. All right, that's liberty.me. Yeah. Okay, so today on the show, the other Scott Horton is going to be on the show. He's the heroic anti-torture international human rights lawyer, former chair of the New York Bar Association's Committees on International Law and on Human Rights, and a law professor at Columbia University in Hofstra. And yeah, you're beginning to get the idea of this guy. Oh, he's against torture. He holds that torture's a crime, and that laws are supposed to apply to government officials. I know, it's a radical position, but he's sticking to it. And anyway, he's done some great journalism. You might remember his piece back from 2010 called The Guantanamo Suicides, in ironical type scare quotes, because of course they were murders. 3 men murdered at the CIA Camp No in one night. And then they covered it up and they pretended it was suicide, and then they said, oh, it was an asymmetric attack against us. You see what they do? They kill themselves in order to make us look bad. Good old America. And that worked until the other Scott Horton busted their ass. Oh, well, him and Seton Law School. Seton Hall is what it's called. Seton is the hospital. Seton Hall is the law school. And so, yeah, that's a thing. He's got a new document proving that he was right and everybody said he was wrong was wrong. And oh, did the right-wingers try to attack him. They would have been better advised to just leave it alone. You had to go and pick a fight with the other Scott Horton, and now, I don't know, I should have stopped by First Things this morning to see if they've got their mea culpa. Oh, sorry. Looks like you've got a case beyond a reasonable doubt now. Should be. Anyway, Scott Horton, he's got more documents, and they prove a couple of things. Murder. And the cover-up. And as I learned as a young kid, because I was born when Gerald Ford was in office, I learned when I was very young, the cover-up is worse than the crime. In fact, no matter what the crime is. Like, for example, if Richard Nixon had covered up the bombing of Laos and Cambodia, he might could have gotten in trouble for that. But just killing a couple of million people, you know, human beings, for no reason at all, yeah, that's all right. It's within his executive authority and everything. Just don't pay hush money to E. Howard Hunt to pretend like it didn't happen. Just don't break into Dan Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office. The cover-up is worse than the crime. Well, in this case, oh, they covered it up. Oh, somebody is guilty of the felony of obstruction of justice. Oh, I can't wait to see the courts and the federal prosecutors come down like a ton of bricks on those who murdered these three men at Guantanamo Bay and then covered it up to make it look like a suicide. Who do you think you are, Bill Clinton? And wouldn't it be funny if I really believed that anyone was going to be held accountable for this? You know what? Speaking of which, I'd like to recommend to you, and I should have saved this for later in the show when we talk about the NSA, but there's a big front line. You might have missed it last week. I had missed it, but I finally caught up over the weekend. And I watched the thing on Frontline about the origins of the NSA program. And now they don't get all Marcy Wheeler technical on all of the law and the technical details and stuff, but they certainly do a good job of telling the story of the NSA program as one continuous effort and the different legalities and loopholes and lies, basically, and pseudo-justifications that they've used to keep it going all this time. But I think the most important part of the whole damn thing was a quote from, I'm 90% sure it was Peter Baker from the New York Times, who's recently come out with a book about Bush and Cheney, which I haven't read but should. But what Peter Baker says is, he's got a quote somewhere. It's a direct quote, he says, of David Addington, who was Dick Cheney's lawyer. And this is what me and other Scott Horton have been talking about on this show. I've been talking with other Scott Horton since 2005 about this. And I think since the very first interview, what we agreed was that these men, the Bush administration, and particularly the vice president, Dick Cheney, and his lawyer, David Addington, and then their servants from there, that they had decided that they were going to break every law that they could, even if they didn't need to, just to prove that they could. Case in point, the NSA spying program. When they got caught, they went to the Democrats in Congress and said, legalize the crimes we've been committing. Now, bitch. And the Democrats said, yes, sir, Mr. President, whatever you say, sir. And they passed the FISA Amendments Act of 2008 that gave full immunity to the government, to the corporations, and all the government and corporate employees who'd been committing these felonies, millions of felony violations of the FISA statute in 1978, legalized it all, handed out immunity to everybody, and said, you know, continue right on. Now, they could have gone to Congress all along. They could have gone to Congress in 2001 or 2002, and it was 2001 is when they started it. They could have gone in 2002 and said, we need everything. And the Congress would have said, whatever you say, master. It's not like they're anything but a PR stunt now, a pretend little debating society so that, you know, seventh grade teachers can pretend that there's a constitutional republic somewhere around here. But they broke the law just to prove that they could. They broke the law to prove that the Commander-in-Chief Clause means That's it. The Commander-in-Chief is the Commander-in-Chief, and that's all you need to know. There's nothing more you need to know. And there's no other word in the Constitution that contradicts the fact that he's the Commander-in-Chief and can do anything. And that includes torture people to death, and that includes pass out immunity to those who he would order to torture people to death, and that, of course, includes, of course, all the NSA spying and all the rest of it. And the quote from Peter Baker in the NSA frontline is of David Addington saying outright that that was their strategy, to just push and push and push and push the limits of executive power, of presidential power, until some greater force stops us. But what greater force? There's no greater force. The American people? Sorta, kinda, if you consider nominating Barack Obama after they were done with their full 8 years. I guess the Supreme Court checked them in a couple of places, but mostly they've gotten away with, they certainly haven't been held accountable, even where they've ended up having to go to Congress to get their crimes legalized. But that was their deliberate plan, and he had the exact quote of David Addington in that front line.
The military-industrial complex. The disastrous rise of misplaced power.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State, by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot, though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one. But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today. Corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The War State by Michael Swanson. Available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com. Or just click the logo in the right-hand margin at ScottHorton.org.
We should take nothing for granted.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. John Pfeffer is going to be on tomorrow. And it's going to bum you out, man. It's about how every time one of these wimpy Democrats starts scaling down anything at all, the war party flips out. And when the Republicans come back in, they just double and triple and quadruple down. And now Pfeffer's not the type to say that the Democrats are any better than the Republicans, I don't think. He'd probably agree the Republicans are worse. You know me, I like to give Obama credit for his cowardice, keeping the U.S. government and the American people out of some messes that he could have gotten us in, at least, or in worse ways, than the interventions that he has done. So there is that. But he's saying, remember at the tail end of the Clinton years where the neocons started putting out rebuilding America's defenses and everything, and they started talking about, oh, you know, Clinton's the biggest hippie in the world, and even though we're still spending $400 billion a year on the military and NATO expansion and bombing Iraq every day, every other day for 8 years straight and all of that. Well, now their new doctrine is three-front war. We got to be able to wage full-scale build-up Cold War in Eastern Europe now, in containing Russia. We've got to be able to invade Africa and pivot our Navy and Air Force to Asia to contain China. And, you know, who knows if they're going to... The Middle East is always there, I guess. They're not going to try to do any more Iraq-style invasion occupations for a while, but the status quo ain't holding up very easy either. So that's a lot of responsibilities the U.S. government has carved out for itself. And with an unabashed hawk, like any of the Republicans, pretty much, perhaps excluding Rand Paul, you know, running headlong and proudly proclaiming in McCain fashion the American responsibility for each and every last crisis. Again, this is no advertisement for the damn Democrats. Just, I think John Pfeffer's right that these neocons, man, they go absolutely stir crazy. And they're not really moving back to the Democrats now. They're basically stuck in the Republican Party now, the neoconservative movement. And they're going absolutely stir crazy out of power. And their influence has been greatly diminished, but they still live. And they still write. And they still know people who could get them a job as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Killing People in the Pentagon when Jeb comes. It's not over yet. And by the way, if you're new and you don't really know what a neocon is or what the hell, you hear that term a lot, you want to really know what it is, read Jim Loeb. There's a place you can go without having to go buy a book about it. You can just read, I don't know, 100 articles by Jim Loeb about the neoconservatives. He's your world's greatest expert for you online. Got a whole archive there at IPS News. Start with All in the Neocon Family, about how, no, really, we are talking about the Podhoretzes and the Crystals and their friends and relations, basically. We're talking about approximately 45 people in the world. And they're really bad guys. It's fun to get to know them. Rightweb.com also is a great resource for that. Typically, you would think that liberals might just get caught up in broad brushing all Republicans and conservatives as all one big corporate born-again Christian right-wing something, oil company something, and not discriminate, right? Republicans, you know them. But no, you got to discriminate and look at who's who. Figure out what's what. Break it down into its little pieces. Why did William F. Buckley hire all ex-communists to staff the National Review? Because they were ex-communists, so they hated the Soviet Union and wanted to wage a Cold War against it. Forget containment, let's roll it back, they said. But meanwhile, American conservatives of that generation, at the time of the founding of the National Review, they didn't want to roll back the Soviet Union, risk hydrogen bomb warfare over domination of the planet Earth. And so Buckley had to go hire a bunch of ex-commie rats. Sidney Hook and James Burnham and Whitaker Chambers and all of the, a ton of them. So you look at the, who's the National Review, and then you look at who's associated with the Israel lobby. The Washington Institute for Near East Policy, the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, the American Enterprise Institute, the Center for Security Policy, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, the Emergency Committee for Israel, the Foreign Policy Initiative, formerly PNAC. You know, Crystal's always got quite a few of these things going at once, so that it looks like there's six Bill Crystals, when really there's just the one. But yeah, oh, also Lockheed. Look at Lockheed. That's the neoconservative movement. All right. So anyway, that's just a great advertisement that I just wrote myself for John Pfeffer's going to be on the show tomorrow. I do go on, don't I? But John Pfeffer's going to be on the show tomorrow, and he's going to talk about how, man, the empire ain't dead and gone yet. It may be bankrupt, and you may know better than the empire at just how far it should push it. And you may assume that it knows at least as good as you do that it's bankrupt and needs to kind of chill out a little bit here, but you can't count on that. Everybody's an individual at the end of the day. And there are a lot of people with a lot of vested interest in running this course to its conclusion. And who can stop them? John Pfeffer on the show tomorrow to break your heart. All right. So, let me complain about news, because I got a ton of it. Justin Raimondo's got this piece at antiwar.com today, and he's right, and it pisses me off. It's called The Return of Nationalism, from Eastern Europe to the Far East, and he's talking about how even Francis Fukuyama, he said, yeah, you know, democracy and markets, that's the end of history, nothing left to fight about, but he acknowledged nationalism and tribalism will still play a large role. That's kind of a different question than the form of government and economy. And so, and in fact, people may be bored with all this peace, and they might try to find reasons to go to war over these old ethnic and religious divisions and nationalist divisions. And so then Justin goes down the recent list, the rise of, you know, very right-wing nationalists in Egypt, and in India. I don't know everything about them. But they've been compared to Nazis before, and they came to these organizations came into existence in the 1930s, right around the same time, and are very right-wing nationalists. And their new president is a right-wing nationalist guy who his party oversaw a pogrom of a couple of thousand people back years ago now. But damn, and he's the new leader in India by a huge majority vote just weeks ago. And then, of course, he talks about the riots in Vietnam against the Chinese factory owners and all of that. And then, of course, America's sock puppet Nazi movement in Ukraine. And on it goes. And you can go down the list, of course, in Iraq and Syria right now. We have major Sunni-Shia splits, and old Arab nationalism is dead. And now it's all much more sectarian. And all this. Modi is the guy's name in India, I meant to say. But now, so here's the thing about this, man, is that, and I just can't let this go because, damn it, you know what? I guess I have to admit that even as a just a stupid little kid, I had the vaguest idea of my own New World Order at the end of the Soviet Union. Well, if the Soviet Union's gone, and Germany's just, you know, Germany now, and not Nazi Germany, the enemy anymore, and all of that, and Japan's our friends and whatever, well then, not that everything's going to be perfect, but hey, we could have a brave new future of peace and, you know, more or less peace between the major powers and trade and, But the Americans, what do they want? They wanted a world empire. Well, some of them wanted a world empire based out of Brussels instead of New York City, but either way, or Washington, D.C., either way, it's a nightmare, and of course, that was much more fanciful. So, at the end of the Soviet Union, in fact, John Walsh has a piece on antiwar.com about this today. Why didn't they invite Russia into NATO? Ah, shut up, Fox News. Because then they would have had to listen to them. They would have had to share power with them. That was what I thought the New World Order was. They're going to bring Russia into NATO, and it's going to be the one world army of the North. I'm talking in the 90s when I was a stupid truther kid, before 9/11. And I thought that was the New World Order, one world government, the UN Security Council with Russia brought into NATO as the one world white army of the North at permanent war against Islamic South Asia and Africans and whoever else they can exploit and steal their resources from. And wasn't that the deal? If New World Order ever meant anything, that's what it meant, right? A one world government. But anyway, instead what happened was they said, screw the UN Security Council, we have the National Security Council. And so we don't need anybody. We can just continue rolling back Russia. Why stop? Why listen to them at all? And they've just kept pushing it and pushing it. And created this world empire, a self-destructive one. And this is the real thing of it. Instead of acting like a limited constitutional republic might have acted at the end of the Cold War. And reaching out an honest hand of friendship and being like Harry Brown and propagandizing the world as to why they should embrace freedom and liberty and be like us because human rights is the highest value in the whole wide world, don't you know, and all of that stuff, then everything would have been fine. If Ron Paul had won in 88 and Harry Brown, you know, when he was done in 96 and all of that, then everything would have been fine. But instead you had a world empire. And you had Alan Greenspan printing money all day to make it all seem free. Where was the peace dividend from the end of the Cold War? They went and blew it immediately, invading Iraq and occupying the Middle East permanently after that and expanding NATO and expanding the whole damn world empire all across the world. 1,000 bases across the world. 1,000 bases across the world. And they printed money and printed money and printed money to make it all seem free. So you didn't crab too much about the fact that you never got that tax cut you were supposed to get from the fall of the Soviet Union. It's just for the duration of the emergency, right? That was the deal. But they made it less painful by inflating the gigantic dot-com bubble of the 90s, but then it popped. It was a big fake bubble. And then they went and with the blowback engendered during the expansion of the world empire in the 90s, they went and doubled and tripled down on the empire after September 11th and expanded even more, and they blew up another giant bubble, a global bubble. Because it wasn't just American real estate and the stock market and everything. It was all those dividends they sold to people all over the world. And malinvestments, as the Austrians call it, all over the world. And so what they did was, not with freedom, not with capitalism, not with constitutionalism, not with what America is supposed to be, but with the corrupt, evil empire and its central bank, their American fascism, boom and busted the whole wide world. And so, yeah, you know what? People of other races, especially in the old world, here too, but especially in the old world, people of other races hate each other. People of other tribes and other religions, and man, they've got a history that they'll never get over. 1,000 years ago was the day before yesterday in the Arab world. Are you kidding? They're not over any of that stuff, and they don't want to be over it. The only way you could get people to stop fighting is to make them all rich. It's prosperity that allows people to paper over these differences. Hey, instead of stabbing each other, how about we'll tell a racist joke and then shake hands and then trade? But then Alan Greenspan and Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, they boom and they busted the whole world twice. Now working on three times since the end of the Cold War. And that's why the world hates America, and that's why the world hates the American way, and that's why in Eastern Europe right now, a lot of those people would way rather be back in the old Warsaw Pact of Soviet totalitarian communism than living as a member of NATO in our so-called free economy. Now, how in the world do you blame them for that? You can't just blame them for that. Yeah, the average Romanian peasant would rather be enslaved by the communists than by us. Okay? We gotta, not we, but, you know, the masters of our empire, they bear responsibility for that. It's not just that the people of Romania love being slaves. It's that, no, really, this is worse. Before, they had to share a really crappy apartment with five families. Now they live in their car. Their broken car. Now they have less than nothing. And damn, America, if your economy, if your free markets and democracy, as Bill Clinton and George W. Bush pretend that you've spread to the world, if those are the choices that people are making in the face of what you've given them, then you are doing the wrong thing. I just don't know what else to tell you. You blew it. Your New World Order sucks. The whole world is voting with their middle fingers. And you know what? Did you see the new Tom Clancy movie? It may not be Clancy, but it's his character, Jack Ryan. He used to always be played by Harrison Ford, right? Well, I downloaded this off the Pirate Bay the other middle of the night. And the plot of the movie is the Russians are going to sell their U.S. treasuries. Now, they don't really explain how it is that the Americans put themselves in this position. No, no, it's all an evil, vengeful, ideological KGB plot to destroy America. But somehow, they've got their hands on so much American debt that if they sell it, we're doomed. That if they stop using dollars, the whole world economy, and including and perhaps especially ours, unravels. Now, you know, I don't know, man. They're just trying to condition us a little bit for when that happens a couple of weeks from now. Whose fault, who we're supposed to blame other than those who printed all this money and created all this debt and spent all that money killing all those people for all those reasons no one can really define. Certainly not as good enough. Yeah, man. That's why there's rising horrible right-wing, reactionary, racist bigotry all over the planet. Now, I didn't really make myself clear enough. In my New World Order, there's no government anywhere. There sure as hell is no world empire of anyone. But you don't need a world empire to have free trade, you see. You could just have, as Ron Paul always says, even in a limited constitutional government, you just have a piece of paper signed, President Paul, we will have no tariffs on you because we don't want to have tariffs on you because that's bad economics. Simple as that. You know, try to work out reciprocal agreements when possible, but this is the thing of it. And by the way, you could be a liberal. You could be anywhere on the shade of left. You could be all the way to the left communist if you want. I don't care. You could be a anarcho-leftist or a communist, or you could be a socialist, or you could be any flavor of progressive or a liberal or any kind of label on the left that you could think of, or you could be any kind of conservative in the world. There's not too many different kinds of conservatives. There's the fascists. Any kind of right-winger, even if you're one of these horrible right-wing nationalists, you know, ethnic nationalists that I'm talking about, everyone, all people must agree, it's just true, about the cause of the boom and the bust. It was Ludwig von Mises that got it all ironed out for you back 100 years ago in The Theory of Money and Credit. And what he said was, it's the expansion of bank credit that causes people, artificially expanded bank credit, that causes people to make bad investments in projects that eventually, mathematical proof-wise, must fail. Some of them must fail. It's basically a bookkeeping trick with the interest rate that fools business people into believing there are more resources to be invested in the whole economy than there really are. It's like musical chairs, right? Each time around, there's one less chair, and somebody gets left on the bad bet. Not that it was a bad bet, all things being equal in a free market, but it's a bad bet in a system where the government expands bank credit in a way. And, of course, they do it to such a degree. You're talking about the entire economy seems to be full of wealth. Many different sectors of it, blown up and blown up and blown up. But then what ends up happening is, and I guess it would pop anyway, but what ends up happening is they start seeing too much price inflation in too many places, and they always try to prick the bubble and let the air out slowly. And that's what Ben Bernanke did in 2007. He started raising the federal funds rate just a little bit, and just a little bit, trying to let the air out of the bubble slowly, but it never works like that. As Murray Rothbard explains in For a New Liberty and in America's Great Depression and in What Has Government Done to Our Money, and in The Case Against the Fed, and probably quite a few other places, it always pops and causes the devastation. But so we see the devastation and say, oh my God, the economy sucks now. What happened? But what happened was it wasn't really as good as it seemed it was the other day. Well, it's a bubble, right? You're up higher on the chart than you belong, but it's all hot air in there. It's not real wealth being created, propping those prices up. So you see. And the Austrians are the only ones who are right about that, and everybody else who has another theory of the business cycle is wrong and perhaps stupid. And that's the answer. And so you don't have to agree with libertarians about any other thing, right? You could be the world's worst everything on everything, but I just think that, you know, if we could come to a consensus about what it is that causes the bust, the artificial boom, and what it is that causes the artificial boom, the government's expansion of bank credit, artificial bank credit. Well, it's really the banks, but backed by the government. And it's a deal. It's a fascist combine, see, between the government and the banks, where the banks promise to buy the government's debt no matter what, and the government promises to license the banks to create new bank credit to buy their debt with and also to loan out to you. So they can make unlimited zillion percent profit on nothing. Because the government and the bankers are all criminals, see? The whole system is wrong, like Lisa Simpson said. It's not bad administrators of it. The system is corrupt in the first place, from the origin of the money on down. And anyway, so there you go. The boom and the bust. Again, you could disagree with me about what to do about it. You could disagree with me about any other, you know, facet of libertarianism. Peace, respect for other humans' dignity, you know, any of that stuff you could reject. But you have to be good on the business cycle theory, because now I explain it to you. And I'll tell you this too. If you go to Wikipedia and go to the references section at the bottom, you can find a great number of books and essays and links to all different authors, pro and con, and get a full debate. You can get all of human action or all the parts of human action by Ludwig von Mises, chapter 20, section 8. And then here's everybody saying, here's what they think is wrong with it. Here's a fight between, here's a Brian Kaplan and Paul Krugman disputing it, right? So, you know, go and learn about it. That's all I'm telling you. I'm not using Wikipedia as a source. I'm using it as a resource. And I'm telling you, you can find a lot of great links to a lot of great differing opinions, and also expansive definitions and explanations of the Austrian business cycle theory. And that's it. And you know what the greats, like Robert Murphy or Robert Higgs, will tell you, Murray Rothbard will tell you, the boom and the bust is completely caught up in American imperial expansion. This is how they defer the costs. If they made you pay your fair share of aggressive wars, you would not go for it. Never, never, never. This is what it's going to cost to invade Iraq, $6 trillion, divided by 300 million people, whatever that is. So here's the portion for everyone in your family. Pay up. The American people would say no. In fact, remember back. During the invasion of Iraq, George Bush sent everyone a $300 check, as though it was your dividend from all the profit being made from invading Iraq. And good people, decent people, were just left, you know, rationalizing, trying to figure it out for themselves, because they don't have good information. So they say things like, well, you know, war is good for the economy. But they're fooled. It's just George Bush printing money out of nothing, sending you your $300 dividend check on trillions of dollars wasted and destroyed, spent killing people. People who are priceless. But that's how they made it seem. You might even remember. Do you remember when they first announced after the invasion of Iraq that the first appropriation going through Congress was going to be $87 billion. And the American people all at once sat up and said, what? Of course, the total ended up being more than 10 times that. I'm no good at math, really. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. All right, y'all, welcome back. All right, so that's it for my moralizing. Let me do the news here now. Iraq's Maliki wins at least 94 parliament seats in the national election. It's not a majority, it's a plurality, but he's way ahead of everybody. Sadr's group picked up 28 seats. The Supreme Islamic Council, 29. Which, is that still the Hakim family or what? I thought Sadr owned the Supreme Islamic Council by now anyway. But of course, the Sunnis have been shut out. They didn't even have the elections in the Sunni provinces for the most part. And he's not really that popular with, apparently, with the Shiite Arab population, but they don't have much anywhere else to go, I guess. Iyad Alawi, the former CIA officer, took 21 seats. That's amazing. The first American sock puppet dictator there has this much support under their third sock puppet dictator there, the guy we've left in charge. Maliki's position is strong, said former National Security Advisor Mufawak al-Rubi, a candidate on Maliki's political slate who emphasized the Prime Minister's experience as Commander-in-Chief. All right, so yeah, people are going to keep dying there. Security ops attacks kill 142, wound 59 across Iraq on May 18th. Margaret Griffiths at antiwar.com. If the Iraqi authorities are to be believed, at least 142 militants were killed in security operations and clashes today. The military is conducting extensive operations in Anbar province, neighboring Babil province, and even north toward Mosul in Nineveh province, which also borders Anbar. Independent confirmation cannot be obtained from the battle zones. Over 40 civilians and security personnel were also killed. At least 180 people were killed, and 59 more were wounded in these attacks and security operations. As long as we're talking Iraq, I wanted to just remind you again about this piece by Gareth Porter. We talked with him about it on the show last week. U.S. political breakout demand could derail nuclear talks. And this is just the big sabotage, adding Iran's missile program as an issue to the nuclear talks. Now, maybe they're being like this just so they can finally at the end say, okay, and drop it and make a deal. Or whether they really mean to blow the damn talks up, I don't know. But it's not looking good. And you know what? Gareth Porter has been saying all along, don't get your hopes up for this kid. So I think, well, he didn't talk like that, but you know. So, guess that's about the end of that. I don't know. Here's Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com today. U.S. faults Iran, warns time is short after latest talks. And that's, again, because they're bringing up these missiles for no real reason, other than perhaps a sabotage to break the deal. No legit reason, I should say. And then at the same time, America has backed Maliki and put him in power there. And he's allies with Iran. And we may or may not be working out a deal and a peace with Iran. America is backing our enemies from the Iraq War and Maliki's current enemies, the Islamic State of Iraq in Syria. They're called the Islamic State of Iraq in Syria. And America's on their side. Yeah, the guys from the last war. No, really. I know it sounds crazy and stupid and wrong, but no, really it is. The only caveat I could add is that, well, you know, they funnel the weapons through deniable channels, like moderate vetted rebels. And then when the weapons end up in the hands of the extremist suicide bomber types, well, geez, we just don't know how that happened. It's almost as if there's a market in weapons in Syria or something. And so they keep sending money and more weapons. And here, Senator Secretary of State John Kerry announces increased weapons shipments to Syria rebels. Won't discuss specific weapons, but vows increased effort. And this, as Daniel McAdams points out, at the Ron Paul Institute, ronpaulinstitute.org. He's got this great piece Why won't Kerry leave Syria alone? It's a spotlight today on antiwar.com. And he's got a link in here to the TOW missiles are already ending up in the hands of the Islamic Front. And the Islamic Front, yeah, that's basically al-Nusra. Or at least, they fight in all the same battles at the very same time. For all we know, al-Nusra just spun off one small section to give it a new name so that they could tell the CIA, okay, we're the vetted guys, give us the weapons and money. And now you got the USA, just like it was the 80s, as though this hadn't ever blown back on us before, arming up al-Qaeda. Mirko in the chat room asked, do the Syrian rebels use the al-Qaeda brand name? Yes, they do. They have sworn and by name, real people. David Enders has reported on this and others. Real, actual people, not some PR stunt, have sworn their loyalty to the goals of Ayman al-Zawahiri. It's now ISIS who are now on the outs with al-Qaeda because he's told them, go back to Iraq and fight Maliki in Iraq. Because they're, apparently for PR reasons, they're, you know, they're such Zarqawiites, they keep killing too many people in the marketplace and at the elementary school and stuff. And so Zawahiri, I guess, has learned a little bit of a lesson in public relations from the last time. But of course, he's a horrible battle commander because all he can really do is give advice. He's hiding in somebody's attic or somebody's basement in Pakistan, presumably, and he has no real authority to enforce anything. And in fact, Zawahiri, they said, and I don't remember exactly my footnotes here, but I think it was McClatchy, Mitchell Prothero, or other credible journalists like that, who talked about Zawahiri sent his guy to Syria to tell ISIS to cool it, and they killed him and said what? So now the guys who are bin Ladenites, only worse, are out of control of the bin Ladenites, and the al-Nusra front are not the moderates, but are apparently the moderates compared to them. And yeah, I mean, these guys are doing the suicide bombings, direct and deliberate attacks on civilians, car bombing schools, and this kind of thing. I mean, they are the madmen, the prisoner beheaders, and they have sworn loyalty to bin Laden, the al-Nusra Front guys. And they do seem a little bit more tame than ISIS, after all. The al-Nusra Front guys, even though they call themselves al-Qaeda, they kidnapped and released our friend David Enders from McClatchy Newspapers. And man, he's a badass journalist. He's been around for a long, long time. I first started interviewing him about Iraq back in 05. And I think he was doing journalism from there before that. But they freaking kidnapped him for a couple of weeks, I think. I interviewed him about it. He wrote about it, McClatchy. And they let him go. Some other journalists in Syria have not been so lucky. But I don't know what to tell you, folks. It's treason. It is. And you know what? I'm so put off by conservatives. I hate even sounding like them at all. Like, you'll hear me attack the Libya intervention all the time. But I'll focus on this Benghazi thing because, first of all, I think it's stupid, really, anyway. But also, just conservatives and their you know, minor bird status, the way they repeat their little talking points and, you know, believe in their stupid little things they believe in. It's ridiculous. You know, the biggest crime of the Obama years is that 4 Americans were killed in Libya? Shut up, man. For God's sake. You could even just read Drudge every day and know better than that. I mean, come on, man. But on this, and overall, the Libya intervention counts too, I think. But on Syria, I just don't know what else to call it but treason. It's treason, man. In fact, here, I got the clip, don't I? Let me find it. Oh, boy, I hope I didn't talk too far out of turn. Well, here's Hillary Clinton admitting that we're backing al-Qaeda in Syria, because the answer to her hypothetical, the way she phrases it, of course, is yes. We are. She is. We are, because she decided to. Absolutely. And then, but I think I got the clip of Obama addressing the same question here, too, for you.
We know al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting al-Qaeda in Syria? Hamas is now supporting the opposition. Are we supporting Hamas in Syria?
Oh, man. Well, I hoped I was going to find it for you. Damn. You know what? I do have it. I'll find it. I know. I'll have it in iTunes. It's Ben Swan. Local news reporter Ben Swan interviewing the President of the United States and saying, hey, what up on you back in Al-Qaeda in Syria, dude? It's so good. Let me see. Swan, Obama, Syria. There we go.
I share that concern, and so what we've done is to say we will provide non-lethal assistance to Syrian opposition leadership that are committed to a political transition, committed to an observance of human rights. We're not going to just dive in and get involved with a civil war that, in fact, involves some elements of people who are genuinely trying to get a better life, but also involve some folks who would, over the long term, do the United States harm.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. Today's show is brought to you in part by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook download at audibletrial.com/Scott. Audible has over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. For Scott Horton Show listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with their free 30-day trial. I personally recommend Dirty Wars by Jeremy Scahill. It's great for anyone wanting the inside story on the cruel and counterproductive terror war of the Obama years. You can sign up for a free 30-day trial and download Dirty Wars at no charge by going to audibletrial.com/Scott. That's audibletrial.com/Scott. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my dang thing here, man. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Check out the chat room, man. We've got a few people hanging out in there. ScottHorton.org/chat. You don't have to use any kind of external applications anymore. Just a plain old browser window. At scotthorton.org/chat. All right. So, I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. I got a bunch more news to cover before we get to the other Scott Horton. He'll be on at the bottom of the hour to talk about the Guantanamo murders. Murders. I wonder if that's in the Senate report. I better make sure and write that down because I remembered it. I thought of that before, but then I forgot it until just now. Senate report mentioned this. Because remember the last time we talked to him, he said he has reason to believe there are more murders than just two in the Senate report. I wonder if he was referring to these three and or many more, I don't know. Mentioned in Senate report. All right. Nice writing, dude. Okay. All right. Now, more news coverage. Is the U.S. behind the rogue General's Libya coup? Check this out. This is Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. General Hifter lived in Metro D.C. for decades. I think that might be all we need to know. Thanks a lot for blowing the... Yeah, no. I guess it's a spoiler, but then again, you don't want to bury the lead either. What do you call it when you try to split the difference between spoiling it and burying the lead? All right, well, anyway. On May 14th, the Marines announced the deployment of 200 to Sicily in southern Italy as a crisis response force for Libya. They did so at the behest of the U.S. State Department, who at the time insisted there was no specific threat nor any imminent plan to evacuate the embassy in Tripoli. Just 4 days later, General Khalifa Haftar and his self-proclaimed Libyan National Army attacked Tripoli, took over parliament, and announced his intention to purge the nation of Islamists, starting with the parliamentarians themselves. It's General Haftar's second attempted coup this year, and seems to be going quite a bit better than the February fiasco, which began with statements announcing his takeover and never really expanded much beyond that. The timing of the Marine deployment suggests this latest move did not come as a major surprise to the administration, but Hifter's U.S. connections may run much deeper. He got his start and his generalship as a close ally of Gaddafi, but changed sides when he was captured during the failed late 80s invasion of Chad. released at the behest of the U.S., after which he was set up as a military leader in the National Front for the Salvation of Liberty. Whoops. Bad timing on the button hitting there, Scott. It's because I flubbed, man, out of Libya. Liberty. Libya. No, liberty is a concept in a ship that the Israelis tried to sink. Libya is got nothing to do with that. A rebel faction message backed by the CIA. The NFSL didn't last much longer in Chad, however, as a takeover of Chad by Gaddafi ally Idris Deby led the U.S. U.S. to evacuate the rebels. Hifter quietly relocated to the D.C. suburbs after that and lived there through 2011, as McClatchy newspapers reported at the time. Anyway, he says he's not CIA, but yeah, he is. He was living in Virginia this whole time. He's been part of the war, and now he's trying to take over the parliament. Could it be that Obama and his government are backing anti-Islamist forces in Libya? Well, that would be a change. I didn't get to finish saying earlier, I hate sounding like a conservative accusing the president of treason. I'm just saying that he's guilty of it. I try not to sloganeer and fearmonger and all that. I'm just talking about technically the crime of treason, even as specifically defined in the Constitution. It applies to the behavior of the President of the United States. He's guilty of that crime, that violation of the penal code. And I'm the guy who started out the show talking about how much worse than him the Republicans really are, which I grudgingly admit, which I hate to admit. But it's true. And it's not because there's anything redeeming about the Democrats at all. It's only just the Republicans are just worse. They're worse thieves and they're worse killers. They're more shameless in their embracing of the totalitarian state. Just can't stand it. As horrible as these years have been, it's nothing like the dark times of the Bush years. It is just like it, but it doesn't feel as bad. That's why all those liberals pissed off and went away. Everything feels okay to them now. I gotta admit, I mean, can you imagine if it had been another 4 years if Bush and Cheney had done some FDR stuff and stayed for two more terms? Think that would have been better than this? All right, that's what I mean. Anyway, so, coup in Libya. I don't know. Would Bush have betrayed his friend Gaddafi in Libya? Probably. I mean, if that's what Ariel Sharon's half a corpse wanted at the time, right? Took so long. All right. And go read all about that Libya crisis at antiwar.com today. And then, by the way, here, Mali, quote, at war with terrorists. After 36 dying clashes, as we've been covering on the show since it was, the war was even still on. I can't believe it was 3 years ago now. Can you believe that? 2011. During that war, we said this thing's going to spread. And what's going to happen is all the consequence from this. And then we tracked it all in real time as it developed, as Gaddafi's former Tuareg mercs took his weapons after his defeat and murder. And they went home to Mali, where autonomy became not good enough. And they tried to secede from the union with southern Mali, which is the French backed power base in the country. But then the jihadists, who had defeated them in Libya, came and defeated them in northern Mali, too, pushed them aside and pushed all the way in, all the way down to southern Mali, and sacked one of the major cities there for a short time, and that finally provoked French intervention last year. But northern Mali's the size of Texas, and desert, too. The size of Texas, only all looking like West Texas. By the way, if you've never been to Texas, man, it's so big. That's why people compare big things to it. Because it's really big, man. Really big. And so's Mali. And there's going to be a terror war from now on. There, we talked with Brendan. I kept wanting to call him Brandon, then I couldn't come up with his last name, but that's because his name ain't Brandon, it's Brendan. Brendan O'Neill from Spiked Online was on to talk, and quoting his sources, these studies that have been written about how Boko Haram went from, they really used to be a peaceful group. Then they became a little bit radical. Then the American war in Libya came and turned Mali upside down. And then a lot, apparently, of these Boko Haram guys went up there and it changed their tactics, their weapons, the nature of their group and their mission and their war. And the war in Mali rages, and now the war in northern Nigeria is picking up even more and more. And, you know, I don't know, man. Gaddafi was not an American enemy. And the Ayatollah in Iran, not an American enemy. The only state in the world out there that's an American enemy actually doesn't exist. Russia and China are frenemies at worst. We've got business with them, man. The old days are over. It ain't that bad. Not yet. I'm not saying they can't make it that bad again. But the Cold War, the real Cold War, is over. There are no enemy states of America. You hear? Go count them up. 194 of them. There are no enemy states of America anywhere. The only enemies of the American people are the acolytes of Ayman al-Zawahiri. And everything our government does, whether it's Bush or Obama, benefits them. And especially this entire invasion of Africa. And there are a couple of great pieces along these lines here. First of all, Militarized Humanitarianism in Africa is written by a woman named Jova Rock. Jova, I guess? J-O-E-V-A. Jova Rock. It's at Interpress Service, ipsnews.net. And it's called Militarized Humanitarianism in Africa, and it's about the entire invasion and takeover of the entire country of Africa by the U.S. government right now. And then there's another great one by Nick Turse, T-U-R-S-E. Tattoo that on your hand or something. Don't forget, he is the best in America on what is being done to Africa on the expansion of the Joint Special Operations Command. And actually, I don't mean to say he's got the deepest understanding of all the politics of American intervention there going way back, because I don't know about that. I'm not saying he's bad on it, but there may be people who are better. But what he is the best on is the expansion of the American military there now. SOCOM and JSOC and the rest of the African command. Hey, they're looking for work. They're looking for ways to stay globally engaged. That is, they don't want to have to get real jobs. So you're going to suck your tax money and kill Africans. And it's about as simple as that. And it's at tomdispatch.com. Nick Turse, How Benghazi Birthed a New Normal in Africa. Nick Turse. Just, in fact, you know what? Type in Nick Turse into whatever brand of search engine you like best. And Africa. And then read everything. And then read it all again. Okay, good. Okay, and so, yeah. Now I'm almost out of time, so let me just mention this real fast. Ah, this should have gone up in the nationalism section. I'll skip. Oh, man. I guess I do have time still to talk about Ukraine and the cops. Okay, let me just mention real quick this great thing on by David Stockman on China and Vietnam about how the lie at the time was we had to intervene. Absolutely had to intervene in Vietnam, because otherwise, if the communists won over the whole place, they'd just be the sock puppets of Ho Chi Minh, and how everybody who knew better said, no, that's not true. And those people were right, and the warmongers were wrong, and millions of people died for nothing. And now we see, again, another example of how much the Vietnamese hate the Chinese from their ancient enmities. That's a David Stockman's Contra Corner. David Stockman's ContraCorner.com. He needs a better URL. Hey, all Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. Other Scott Horton's going to be here in just a few minutes. Hope I'm prepared for this interview, man. It's a complicated subject, a very narrow one. All the evidence of the murder of these men and the political repercussions and the... What about Eric Holder? All right, well, other Scott Horton, he's going to be on to talk about three men tortured to death by the U.S. government at Camp No. Camp No. Down there at Guantanamo Bay. It's otherwise known as Penny Lane. It's a very happy, fun place. Where those tortured so badly that they turn into rats can live in a little bit of comfort. Oh, yeah, closed after this happened. I forgot about that. Oh, yeah. I have to write these things down or else I will space them out. All right, here comes news. New Greenwald finally here at The Intercept. By the way, lots of good interviews of Greenwald if you like interviews of Greenwald. I do. I think all the anti-Greenwald people are all wet. Best journalists ever. Journalist of the century so far by a million times. And I guess if I was a reporter too, I'd be jealous as hell. But I'm not a reporter. I'm just a fan. So I'm extremely proud of him and all the great work that he's done and is still doing. And so his new book is out. I haven't read it yet because I've been broke as a joke, man. Honestly, I have not even been able to go and spend $20 on a damn book. I'm going to try to go get it today, actually. But anyway... so he's been doing lots of interviews, and if you go to glenngreenwald.com, you can see, or no, it's glenngreenwald.net. It's basically like his book promotion page, which is okay. And he's got a collection of all his TV interviews and that kind of thing there, if you like that kind of thing, which I do. But here he is with a new one at The Intercept, Data Pirates of the Caribbean. The NSA is recording every cell phone call in the Bahamas. And I haven't even had a chance to read this yet, so I don't know if he's talking right here. Is this the country that they talked about before, where in at least one country they're recording every telephone call? Somal get. Woo-wee. I once met a guy from the Bahamas. And he explained to me why people from the Bahamas hate America and Americans. They hate America, the government, for all the horrible things that it does to them all the time. And they hate us for not knowing or caring about it at all. But he talked about, you know, you think the drug war is bad in your neighborhood. It's waged by actual soldiers of you guys in our neighborhood. And it's ugly. You don't ever hear any coverage of it at all, but it's ugly as hell, man. And if you have any savings at all, they'll come out of helicopters in the middle of the night and take the whole bank in the name of, oh, it was holding the deposit of some drug dealer or whatever. There is no law that can constrain the power of the American empire. And so average people in places where you might think down in the Bahamas, they just are so happy to see you and sell you some trinkets and they just love you because Americans are so cool and they just... want to be just like you, but no. He even said to me, this is what he said to me, he said, the Coast Guard, when you think of the Coast Guard, you think of guys in clean, crispy, ironed, white dress uniforms out patrolling around rescuing people. That was what he said. It wasn't the Marines, it was the Coast Guard. When you think of the Coast Guard, you think of guys in crispy, white sailor uniforms out rescuing yachtsmen. Well, when we think of the Coast Guard, we think of Black Hawk helicopters and Special Forces guys with machine guns rappelling in the middle of the night and terrorizing and or killing our people and taking our stuff. That's the Coast Guard, so glad to know you guys are sleeping tight at night with the Coast Guard out there protecting you and everything, but they're the stormtroopers of death where I live. I'm paraphrasing roughly, but not very. He was a nice guy. I like this guy, man. I'm glad I talked to him. He taught me some things. Anyway, so there's Glenn Greenwald. Data Pirates of the Caribbean. The NSA is recording every cell phone call in the Bahamas. And I got quite a bit of what have you here for you, too. documents, etc. All right. Now, this is very important. We talked with Marcy Wheeler about this on the show. The NSA, the USA Freedom Act, the NSA Reform Act, she started calling it the Freedom Act. Uh-oh. Because they took all the good parts out. It's just a charade. And it was never going to be great, although it wasn't a completely cynical Patriot Act type maneuver where the worse it is, the more patriotic a name you have to give it. It wasn't really like that. It was actually meant at the beginning to be a pretty significant reform, but no longer. You can read all about that at antiwar.com. And in fact, at McClatchyDC.com, bill to curb NSA spying looks like change, but isn't really. And this is really good for a mainstream newspaper chain. I mean, honestly, you know what it is? It's just sound and honest analysis of an issue. But it's the kind of thing that to tell the truth is to really contradict the official narrative. And so it's the kind of thing where maybe a newspaper might decide not to write an article like this. But in this case, no, they wrote it, and it's good. The title could be, "They Are Lying to You." They're trying to deceive you because they hate you, because they, the Congress, they are your enemy. Your deadly enemy. Yeah. But instead it's called Bill to Curb NSA Spying Looks Like Change, but Isn't Really. And it's a very well done article. And by the way, you probably saw this, and it's pretty weak tea, but it's notable anyway. I don't know what it means. You tell me what it means, but I'll tell you that it's a fact that Cisco has had to come out and respond to the revelations in the Greenwald book and say, please, government, cut us a break here. You are absolutely blowing up our business. And he dresses it up like, oh, come on, the confidence of the consumer in the financial interrelated, please stop blowing up our business. And this is something that's going on. This is what a lot of the tech companies have had against the NSA program all along. The bottom line, who's going to buy a Cisco router now when they know that one of them little mysterious transistors on there is ratting them out to the NSA and they don't know which one it is? Would you? Right, I know. Me either. I would get one from some other company made in some other country. Take my chances there at least. Oh, and I'm sorry, I meant to say, Marcy has another one. Marcy has many of them, but go to emptywheel.net and you can read Mike Rogers, USA Freedom Act only changes phone dragnet. And so here she says, see, this is what I was telling you, but now here's this jerk bragging about it, that the bulk collection that it will be banned in any form, in slight form, in the USA Freedom Act only applies to the telephone records collection and does not apply to all the rest of everything else they're doing, which is, of course, keeping track of all the rest of everything that you're doing, including your cell phone location data and all of your financial data and everything else. And, you know, to misquote something I saw, Ron Paul said something this morning, somebody quoted him as saying, if you think, this is more or less right. If you think a police state can't happen here, then you're not a very good student of history. Wow, that's a pretty judgmental thing for Ron Paul to say. Ron Paul usually is not so harsh. But here he's saying like, hey man, actually, you know what? Pick up, I don't know, one book. And you'll find out that, oh yeah, totalitarian slavery can indeed come to your town. What it takes is you always doing everything you can to make sure that it doesn't, to keep it from doing so. And, oh man, I'm out of time to talk about the cops. Oh my God, dude, there's so much. Oh, and all the Ukraine stuff. And Israel. You know what? I'll tell you this about the cops. Go to libertycrier.com today and look at what the cops of America are up to now. Compare that, and then compare it to Andy Griffith and Don Knotts, and tell me where you're living. In TV land? In a free country at all? Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for OffNow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the Off Now project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our guest today is the other Scott Horton, heroic international anti-torture human rights lawyer, former chair of the New York Bar Association's committees on human rights and on international law, a professor of law at Columbia Law School and at Hofstra, and contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, the oldest magazine in America. And he's got a brand new one out. I don't know if it's online, but it's in the print issue here. Short and sweet, The Guantanamo Suicides Revisited. Welcome back to the show, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Great to be with you.
Oh, no. What happened to my audio? It's terrible.
Can you not hear me?
Oh, there you are.
Yep.
You're back.
Sorry about that. Okay.
All right. Good deal. Welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm fine.
Okay, great. So, vindication. Sad story, but hey, your journalism, I believe, here proven correct now. I don't know who could argue with this, but let's go back. As you put it here, the night of June 9th, 2006, three detainees died at Guantanamo Bay Naval Base. And then you came out with a story back in 2010 saying that the government story that these men had all committed suicide in order to make America look bad was not true, that they apparently had been murdered. And then so now you have some new documents. So I guess if you want to go back and fill us in a bit on the story, your witnesses, your journalism, and then catch us up on the new document and what all we learn from it.
Well, originally, when this happened on June 9, remember, the next morning, it was electrifying news all around the world that three people had died at Guantanamo, and Admiral Harris, who's now the commander of the Pacific Fleet, went before the press and said this was an act of asymmetrical, an asymmetrical attack on the United States. That's how he described the alleged suicides. He said
that it was a PR stunt, basically.
Exactly, designed to attack the U.S. Then there was an NCIS investigation conducted, and the government was unbelievably secret about this. So it wouldn't let any information out. It was kept tightly locked up for more than 3 years. Finally, it came out through FOIA requests, heavily redacted. So redacted so heavily, it was almost impossible to make any sense of it. But you know, a group of law students, especially a group of students and professors at Seton Hall in New Jersey, went over it, pieced it together bit by bit, trying to make sense of it, and they distilled in from the government, the government's own narrative of how these people had died. And I think all the experts who looked at it read the narrative and said, that's not possible. It described the three of them doing a coordinated suicide, each of them in his own cell at the same time, wrapping cloth around their throats, cloth that actually had not been present in the cells only a few minutes before the suicides occurred, hanging themselves from the top bars and the wall of the cells, and wrapping their hands and their feet with cloth. And it said that they each had forced cloth down their throats to muffle their sounds. Of course, in all the medical examiners we asked to look at this, who said, nope, not possible. They all focused on the cloth down the throat, saying that, well, actually, there's a gag reflex that occurs. Just try and stuff some cloth down your throat. I mean, you can't do it. So there's just no way somebody could have done that as an act of suicide. So it was immediately, flagged by all the medical experts as not plausible.
I was going to say, that's some real discipline on their part, if they can do that.
Yeah, I mean, impossible, basically. And then we had four NCOs who were on duty that evening, the perimeter guards, come forward, and this was the basis of my story. And they said, you know, the starting point for the NCIA narrative is that they committed suicide in their cells. But these guards said, you know, they weren't in their cells that evening. We know because we watched them being extracted from the alpha cell block. We saw a vehicle come and go three times, picking up three prisoners from that cell block and taking them to a facility that we call Camp No, which we now know is run by the CIA at this time. And the CIA called it Penning Lane. And I think for the time my article was run until today, we've had, you know, two major additional breakthroughs, and then now this is the third. Mm-hmm. You know, the first was a study done by the University of California at Davis in which they said, you know, this process of stuffing cloth down mouths is something we find evidence of in other detention facilities about the same time, and it's a procedure called dry boarding. It's something like waterboarding. Doesn't involve water, but it involves the same basic technique, which is trying to induce a sensation of asphyxiation. And then we had a story done by Matt Apuzzo and Adam Goldman, then at the Associated Press, back at the end of last year, right at the end of the year, in which they got a number of corroborated accounts from the CIA, people at the CIA, saying, well, at that facility, the CIA called that facility Penning Lane, and what we were running there was this massive PSYOPs operation designed to turn prisoners who were scheduled for release from Guantanamo. All these three guys were scheduled for release, and we wanted to turn them into U.S. assets. And there was a complex psychological preparatory process that went on to induce a state called learned helplessness. And, of course, waterboarding and these other techniques were used in connection with that. And now we have this new document, which is something from the NCIS report done in the first hours after the NCIS came in and started doing their review.
Now, hold it right there, actually, because there's going to be so much to go over in the new document here. I want to see if I can follow up on just a couple of things to clarify before we move on, because we've got the time here. First of all, how certain are you? Are you completely certain that this Camp No and that Penny Lane are the very same thing?
100%.
Okay, and now, I believe that, I don't know who all is we, but didn't we all know that CIA had a base there all along, and I wonder whether, did you always know that Camp No was the CIA base, or there was a discrepancy, you still weren't sure whether there was a different base that was the CIA one, or what's that?
They actually had two bases. They had another one called Strawberry Fields, which is another facility. So one of the we did not know before Matt and Adam did their article that Camp No and Penning Lane were the same thing and it was a CIA facility. We had a bunch of sources telling us this was definitely an intelligence facility, but they wouldn't narrow it down to whether it was CIA or defense intelligence or something else.
And so now we know why they closed it. It was after these suicides, so-called suicides, was why they closed it down back in 06.
I think that's a fair premise because it's like right after these suicides occurred, the decision is made to shut it down. Not just that, but it's after these suicides occurred that the National Security Council then takes a decision to shut down the entire black site operation and get the CIA basically out of this special interrogation program, also to change the parameters of the interrogation program. And of course, it's been suggested that there were, quote, a lot of serious mistakes, close quote, made by the CIA in connection with the program, and I think now we're looking at one of them.
Uh-huh. Well, now, the last time we spoke, just a few weeks ago, about the Senate report, you said that you suspected that there were many more than just the two that were already, you know, official deaths in CIA custody in the Black Site program, and that you suspected there were quite a few more. I wonder now if this is what you were referring to, or you think many more than that, perhaps?
Bingo. No, I think these three definitely can be now very clearly connected directly with the program. And I think one of the questions is, you know, why such extreme efforts to cover it up and to say it's something other than what it was, and why these extreme efforts involved the Justice Department.
We got to get to the new documents and the cover up in a second. I still got a couple more follow-ups here. There is a broken neck bone story that you had done as a follow-up to. I just wanted to mention about the discrepancies over the autopsy. I don't know if you want to get into that or not, but
well, that's right because the families of the three requested that their bodies be made available for independent autopsy, and one of the bodies was in fact shipped to Switzerland to be reviewed. And when the doctors there, very famous pathologists in Switzerland, examined the body, he said, "Well, wait a minute, this is supposedly a suicide." With sort of differing indications about what happened, but the neck has been removed, making it impossible to tell exactly how death occurred. So the death definitely occurred having to do with the windpipe and asphyxiation, but it was not at all clear that the death occurred as a result of a ligature, that is, a noose being applied. So that was one of the huge questions, and, you know, the
a huge indication of a cover-up there, a whole other crime of obstruction there.
Exactly, and the doctor in Lausanne tried to communicate with the Department of Defense, saying, okay, you can remove it, that's fine, but you should allow me to examine it. And they refused any communication with him. And in fact, I know, and I subsequently saw an email sent by the Department of Defense pathologist who was responsible saying, I'm sorry, I know it's professionally correct that I cooperate with you, but I have been ordered not to speak to you or to respond to your requests. So there was, you know, there were high level orders given to block, you know, a meaningful check of the pathologist's report,
and under the excuse that, well, he's a foreigner or something, he's outside of their chain of command, so they don't have to.
Actually, it's a violation of international health and safety rules and a violation of the Geneva Conventions, which actually required them to cooperate.
Wow.
So it was an illegal move that was done.
All right, now we're about to have to go out to break, so let me just ask you real quick, and maybe you won't have time to answer all the way, but what about, I still don't understand how it makes sense that they would kill three guys the same way, what, all at the exact same time, and one after the other on one night?
Yeah, well,
now the damn music's playing already. I'm terrible at timing this thing. It's a hard break, Scott, and we got to take it, but
when we come back.
It's the other Scott Horton, everybody, the heroic anti-torture international human rights lawyer and journalist from Harpers.org. And his case is even more proven than ever before about the murders there at Penny Lane in 06. And we'll be right back after this. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at CouncilForTheNationalInterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at CouncilForTheNationalInterest.org.
Listen, if the detainee dies, you're doing it wrong. That was right there in the memos from Guantanamo Bay. Try it different next time. I don't know. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with the real Scott Horton, the other Scott Horton, the heroic anti-torture international human rights lawyer and former chair of the New York Bar Association's Committees on Human Rights and International Law and professor at Hofstra in Columbia and journalist at Harper's Magazine, the oldest magazine in America. And he's written this article, The Guantanamo Suicides, back in 2010. Ironic quotes around suicides, a couple follow-ups since then, and now including a brand new document. We're going to get to that and the cover-up in just a second, but first, I'm sorry I set you up right before the break there, Scott. I still don't understand how the hell you suffocate three people with dry rags down their throat all at the same time or all on the same night and get into such trouble if you're a CIA guy out at Penny Lane in the summer of 2006. Help me understand.
Well, I think we got to start with the word murder because you used it before. And I would say at this point, we don't know. We know that there were homicides. We don't know that there were murders because we don't know all the details of exactly what happened. I think it's clear that these three people were taken to Penny Lane, that they were subjected to some sort of procedure there, and that they emerged dead or close to death. But there are issues of intentionality that go here. And here, I think what happened is that a technique was being applied to them, and it was misapplied or not correctly applied. In the way the cloth was probably too large in volume, and it was probably put in too far. And so instead of just creating a sensation of asphyxiation, it actually caused them to choke to death. Or at least two of them, because I guess now the news we've got with the third one is that he survived for several hours afterwards. I mean, that's the big information that comes from this new document.
And with that, I'll just turn my mic off and let you explain.
Which the document is a interview notes from a NCIS interview conducted with a military policeman, Master at Arms Denny is his name, done right after the NCIS started its investigation. And this guy says he was called to escort one of the prisoners to the hospital. He got to the detainee clinic. He found the prisoner was already there and said, like, what the hell's going on? He's not supposed to come to the clinic except through a medical escort, but this guy didn't have an escort, so something is strange. And of course, the response we've got for that, as documented in the previous article, is that they were never in the cell blocks. They were dropped at the clinic from Penny Lane. That's what the guards appear to have seen. But then he feels the guy's pulse and realizes he's alive. He's not dead. And he says this guy is sitting there choking with the noose around his neck and all these other bandages. No one's attempting to apply CPR or try to revive him. They're just standing around watching. And so he gets very agitated about that. And he also notices that another guard is there wrapping his hands with these bandages. And he says, you know, it's the same bandages that the guy's got around his throat and around his feet. So the NCIS report claims that these bandages were applied by the prisoners themselves as they attempted to commit suicide. Now we have documentation showing that, no, it's one of the guards applying them, obviously trying to stage or create the appearance of the suicide had occurred. He then starts to escort the guy to an ambulance, and then he's driven over to the hospital, and they apply CPR as he's being moved. But he still has the ligature, the noose around his neck. So, of course, applying CPR while that's in place, choking him, doesn't help him. It probably makes his physical condition actually worse.
I'm sorry, Scott, by this time we're talking how much later after this guy has found him here and said, hey, what's going on, and started working on him?
We're talking more than an hour later. So this is basically, we're looking at 3 hours after the time when, according to the military reports, these people were dead, all dead in their cells. Man. And the guy is not dead. He's still alive. At the hospital, he's taken... they begin some revival efforts, but what's going on is the command post is calling, asking over and over again, is he dead yet? It's a surreal, really disturbing scenario that's described here, with people standing around waiting for this prisoner, sort of not happy about the fact that this guy is still alive, standing around waiting for him to expire and then expressing relief when he does expire. When he does finally die. Through most of the time, no efforts being undertaken. He's surrounded by medical professionals all around in a clinic and in a hospital. Most of the time, no efforts being taken to revive him. And then when things are done to revive him, they're actually harmful to him rather than helpful to him. So it's a very, very disturbing situation that's described. And then this document was to have been an appendix, Exhibit 25, to the NCIS report. When you look at the NCIS report, it says that there is an Exhibit 25 there. When you go back to and see what they've disclosed as Exhibit 25, it's 3 pages from 2 different documents which have nothing to do with the actual Exhibit 25. And this document is then found in a haystack of other papers. When we get the document, start looking at it, it's really some very, very good forensic work by some students at Seton Hall Law School. They get this document, they think, this is Exhibit 25, and someone has doctored it. They use Adobe Acrobat, and they go in and start removing some of the redaction blockage of text and find underneath, indeed, Exhibit 25, the mark.
I love it when that happens, when they do the redactions wrong and people can just go hit Control-Z on it and clear
exactly.
everything up.
It's another great example of how not to do redaction.
Yeah. Well, we don't want to give them too much. Well, I'm sure they took note. Anyway, yeah, no, so this is incredible. I mean, I learned this, I was telling the audience earlier, I was born when Gerald Ford was president. So I've just been raised with my whole life with this wisdom, this conventional wisdom, this kind of just basic truth about life that it's when you lie about it is when you really get in trouble. It's the cover-up that really gets you in trouble, because now how many different federal prosecutors and U.S. attorneys have a reason to nail somebody to the wall for obstruction of justice? You just can't go and remove report contents like this. Isn't that some kind of fraud in a legal case?
Well, definitely. I mean, you know, to start with, we've got homicides going on, and the homicides are being obscured, so that's obstruction of justice. Now, the problem we've got here is who's taking a lead role in the obstruction? The Department of Justice seems to be taking a lead role in the obstruction. And that's something else that's going to be coming out in the next few days in the major report that's been done by the students at Seton Hall, in which they document how the Justice Department covered up what went on and tried to throw congressional investigators off the scent by giving them false information. There are a series of letters and there are emails between people inside the Justice Department trying to coordinate misstatements to members of Congress about what happened.
Wow. Yeah, you know, I know a guy who used to jokingly say that he thought the entire Monica Lewinsky thing was just a stunt to get rid of the independent prosecutor statute. Because, boy, they hate having those independent prosecutors, you know? And I guess they can still do one in exceptional circumstances, but they sort of got to pass an ad hoc thing to do it rather than having a statute that's supposed to kick in, right?
Yeah, well, the Attorney General has the discretion to appoint one if he wants to. What happened, though, was previously we had a statute that said if Congress demanded it, they had to do it. But, you know, what we have here is a situation where, you know, it's clear that the Justice Department is a part of the problem, so to speak. They can't be credibly expected to investigate it. So the only way this could be dealt with really would be through the appointment of some sort of independent prosecutor.
Mm. Well, and so now Harper's Magazine is a pretty big deal. I mean, I don't think they can just completely ignore this. I know it didn't get a whole lot of traction back when the story broke before. But this is some really powerful stuff that you're publishing here in the form of this document in Harper's Magazine. So I wonder if you think that politics, or do you have any signals yet that politics are changing on this question? Maybe some congressmen are going to take up the issue or anything like that.
Well, this is really right in the heart of this dispute between the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence and the CIA. That report is done. It's awaiting declassification and publication right now. And the disclosures here go to the CIA's PSYOPs operation at Guantanamo, which we know already from the report surrounding the Senate committee report is one of the areas where the CIA was pushing back most aggressively and refusing to give information to the Senate investigators. So I think one of the questions we're going to look at right now is, you know, did the Senate investigators ever get any information about this, or were they stonewalled? And I expect to see that the Senate was stonewalled about this, that they did not get information about it. So I think we're going to see the stage set for a follow-up inquiry.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time and your great journalism on this, Scott.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Great to be with you.
All right, everybody, that's the other Scott Horton, heroic anti-torture international human rights lawyer at harpers.org. Check out his blog, No Comment. And it's in the print issue here, follow-up, a missing document, and a new obstruction case. See you tomorrow.